Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rates and Lanes with your hosts Rico Muhammad and Chuck Snow.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Rates and Lanes podcast. I'm your host, Rico Muhammad. We'll be joined shortly by my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow. Looking forward to this evening's show. We have always look forward to our special guest that we have on with us. Always look forward to having him on with us and listening to a wealth of knowledge that he brings to the table. And definitely get your pens and pads out. Good thing that the show's recorded. You can go back and listen to it if you missed something. But if you're sitting still and you got a chance to get your pen and pad out, definitely I recommend doing so, because our special guest this evening, Rick Gobble, brings a wealth of knowledge of the trucking industry and the rules and regulations in which govern our industry. So that's who will be joining us as our special guest this evening. But without any further ado, let's start off, as we normally always do, with this week's trend lines report from DAT. And we're showing that the national average price of diesel fuel has climbed by 1.6 percentage points since last week. That national average is holding steady at $3.78 per gallon. Line haul rates returned to normal January downward trend. Falling line haul rates offset by rising fuel surcharges. Seasonality returned to the spot market last week after surprising increases in the prior week. While higher fuel costs led to increased all rates, the line haul portion of the drive-in rates dropped by 2 cents per mile. Reefers fell by 1 cent, and flatbeds also seen that 2 cents per mile decline. These are still record high monthly averages through the spot rates, though the spot rates are still around the 68 cent high per mile than they were at the very same time of last year. All three equipment types combined, load posts have doubled during the same time. So let's take a deeper dive and see how the rates were performing over the week, starting out with the drive-in portion of the report. Taking a look up in the northeastern corridor, we're showing that the average outbound spot market rate for drive-in checks in at $2.87 per mile. Dropping down to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we're showing that the average outbound rate for drive-ins at $2.92. Moving up into the Midwest, we're showing that the average outbound spot market rate for drive-ins at $3.38. Dropping down to the South Central region, we're showing that that rate comes in at about $2.80 per mile. And leading the nation for drive-ins coming out of the West Coast, we're showing that the average outbound spot market rate checks in right around $3.40 per mile. Shifting gears and jumping over to the flatbed portion of the report, starting out up in that upper northeastern corridor, we're showing that the national average outbound spot market rate out there is $3.11. Dropping down to the southeast and mid-Atlantic states, we're showing that the average outbound rate checks in at $3.19 for flatbeds. Moving back up into the Midwest, leading the nation, we're showing the average outbound rate at $3.39 for flatbeds. Coming out of the South Central region, we're showing that the average rate checks in at an even $3 per mile. And coming out of the West Coast, bringing up the rear, showing that the average outbound rate for flatbeds is at $2.94 per mile. Jumping over to the temperature control or reefer portion of the report, starting out up in that upper northeastern corridor, we're showing that the average outbound spot market rate checks in at $3.20 per mile. Moving down to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we're showing that the average outbound rate is at $3.11. Coming out of the Midwest, we're showing that the average outbound spot market rate leads the nation at $3.93. Coming out of the South Central region, we're showing that the average outbound rate checks in at $3.51. And coming out of the West Coast, we're showing that the average outbound spot market rate checks in at $3.89. And with that being said, and without any further ado, let's welcome my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow, to the show. Good evening, Chuck. How are you?
Oh, we're doing well, Rico. How are you doing?
I really cannot complain, Chuck. It's been an interesting, you know, January has just blown by. We are literally at the end of January already, and it's been an interesting turn of the new year and everything. It's been very interesting. How about yourself? How are things on your side of the world?
Well, we're busy. We're busy as can be. It's wonderful. It's by far the best January we've ever seen, in our 42-year history, by far. Blowing the doors off of anything else. There's no other year even comparable. And besides for that, we're domiciled in Canada. That's where our head office is, and that's where I live. There's quite the protest going on here that started out with some truckers that were protesting the vaccine mandates at the border. Now, pretty much the same time as Biden, almost the same day, the Biden administration said the 22nd of January, nobody come into the U.S., no trucker anyways, from Canada or Mexico without being vaccinated. Canada said the same thing. No U.S. driver can come into Canada without being vaccinated. And furthermore, if you're a Canadian truck driver and you're not vaccinated, you either need to take a test or you need to quarantine. So a bunch of guys got really angry, although this whole thing with the Biden administration has been going on for months, and they gave, in all fairness, they did give fair warning that this is how it was going to be. And anyways, these truckers decided to protest, and the protest has been joined by all sorts of people, some truckers that are even vaccinated, and by all sorts of other people. I'm very surprised. I couldn't believe that the emails I got from old customers and people I knew from years ago saying, wonderful what you truckers are doing as far as protesting our rights. You know, I didn't realize Canadians were so righteous. This is all news to me. So the word on the street, now I heard this today, actually Dean Croak had heard it, that, you know, they're thinking it, that they're going to be joined by a total of 500,000 people, not all of them truckers, who are anti-vaccine, but they're really, I think the bottom line is, it's not just anti-vaccine. I think they are probably just worn out. They are tired of the restrictions. I think Canada has probably been overall stricter than most of the other countries. And I think in almost 2 years, I think people have gotten very weary of having, you know, restrictions, whether it's kids not in school, restaurants closed, all the rest of it. I think that's more of it. I think that's what the big crux is right now. So it's kind of interesting, but there's certainly an awful lot of trucks out there that are protesting, and they're slowing down traffic in front of the international bridges and all sorts of stuff. We've never seen anything like this before.
Yeah, it's quite interesting indeed. I think that most people are kind of grown weary of the whole mandate situation. I don't think that they have a problem with. I think for the most part, people are fine that if as your personal choice, if that's something that you decided to do, okay, great. But I think that the pushback is coming on the whole mandated part. I don't think anybody wants to be forced into having to do something that they don't necessarily agree with or believe in. I think that's where the main pushback is coming from.
I agree. I think that's part of it. And I think another part is that just in general, people are just so worn out. They've had enough. They've had 2 years of it.
Absolutely.
You know, here in North America, we have boundless freedoms in North America, or we did up until 2 years ago, that most other countries didn't have. And all of a sudden, for the first time in our lives, we have had restrictions, and we haven't had them in generations. And I don't think people are coping well with it.
Okay, without any further ado, Chuck, I had to double check. I had to double check my system to make sure that our guest was up and on board with us, and he is sitting in the green room waiting on us, so I don't want to keep him waiting.
Well, let's get him on.
So without any further ado, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to welcome our good friend of the show. He's been on with us before, Mr. Rick Gobble. You have to forgive me. I forget your whole title and everything. If you want to give people your title, by all means, do so. But we're so glad that you are so gracious with your time to come back on the Racing Lane podcast and join us, and we're looking forward to picking your brain even further.
You know, for 35 years, I had a title, Rico. You know, I was a special agent, or I was a federal program specialist. I was a state program specialist. I was a division administrator. And then way back there now, which seems like a lifetime ago, I retired, and all of a sudden I woke up one morning and I didn't have a title anymore. The only title I got now is one I bestowed on myself. I started a company after I retired from FMCSA and Federal Highway Administration, Interstate Commerce Commission, and Tennessee Public Service Commission. I always had a title. So when I retired, I had to go make my own title. And I never will forget someone said one time, said they referred to someone as Mr. And they called themselves Mr. And whoever that was said, you know, Mr. is a title to be bestowed upon someone, not a title to be bestowed upon oneself. I always remember that, you know. Chuck's analysis is pretty good. I'm an old country boy. I grew up down here in Tennessee, and I'm kind of a little bit like Jerry Clyer. If anybody remembers old Jerry Clyer, you know.
Oh yeah.
He said, as people I grew up with, you can't back a bobcat up in a cave any further he can go. And I remember that, and I think sometimes when they keep putting these mandates on us, they keep putting all this stuff on us about what we would or should or could do, you know, or they're going to require us to do it. I think about back that bobcat up in that cave as far as it can go. And that's the last thing you want to do is back a bobcat up in the cave, and he can't go no further. He's fixing to come out of there, and he's going to come out either over you, through you, or by you, you know?
Very true.
I absolutely agree. Well, Rick, you know, we hadn't got a chance to get you on. It's the first of the year. It's January. Is there anything new that is coming down that we might need to be aware of, or something that we might need to be more conscious of starting out with the new year, with the new calendar year flipping over? I know there always seems to be something that they kind of sneak in under the radar. Is there something that you might be able to help make us aware of with as far as the regulations and things of that sort is concerned of?
You know, Rico, I'm always it always interests me when you on your show and you talk about freight rates. Freight rates, and of course, coming out of the Interstate Commerce Commission, my dad was an owner-operator from a clean trucking company back right after they chiseled them corners off the wheels, you know. But the freight rates I hear now, you know, it's kind of like an old farmer down there at home used to say about raising hogs, that you know, to make any money in the hog business, you got to stay in the hog business. You can't get out and come back in. When you get out when the price gets low, and you come back in when the price gets high. Well, and that's exactly what we've got with trucking industry. You know, my dad was pleased to get $1, $1.50 a mile when he was running back in those days. And then after deregulation, they kind of cut those rates. The rates got cut down to about 80 cents a mile. Now we're talking about, what, $2.50, $3, $3.50 a mile freight rates. And it's kind of like what's going to happen is that the capacity will outrun the supply of freight. And we will see that when these folks get on the internet tonight and see all these freight rates, and they realize there's people sitting around right now on a computer. They've called Ryder Rental or Penske or somebody today, and they found out that they can rent a truck for so much a mile. They called a couple people that might come drive for them. They figured this is how much they want a mile, and they're figuring right now how much money they can make per mile if they go in the trucking business for $300, get their authority, go find somebody that might insure them, file agents for process, and next thing you know, they're operating in a trucking business. Then what happens when the freight rates go down? They go down because they hadn't figured that far ahead. And I you know, I'm certainly not an expert in the trucking industry. If I'd been an expert in the trucking industry, I'd made some real money in my life. But I've been an old government employee, and now a consultant in truck safety. But I'd been like Mike Starnes of the MS Carriers. You know, I knew Mike Starnes when he owned 6 trucks, and I knew Mike Starnes when he owned 7,000 trucks. Mike was a businessman. I wasn't a businessman. I was a government employee. There's a gap in there that you can't throw a rock that far, you know. But I am excited about these freight rates. I hope the people in business now make some real good money. I hope the capacity don't exceed the cargo supply for some time now. But I'm excited for people in business now. I hope it makes money. I hope we stay in business for a long time.
Well, you know what, Rick? It's funny you say that. I think what will prevent a lot of people from getting into it or expanding is, for the first time in my memory, you can't get equipment. I've never seen anything like this in my life. So even, you know, even a fair-sized carrier of 100 trucks, and he wants to expand by 110, like 10 trucks, which is 10%, which isn't really that lofty when you're that size. He or she could not buy 10 trucks if they tried.
Well, and I see that I read Transport Topics every week and a couple other trade, Commercial Car Journal, and I do see there's a real back order on trucks. But then I get these emails from these guys that somebody is selling used trucks. So I don't know what that capacity is. I don't know what the ability is out there. You know, that's not a bad thing for us in business right now, as long as our supply of freight continues to exceed the capacity of vehicles out there. And I'm not trying to be an economist. I don't know about any of this stuff. But just what I read is, I think right now is probably a pretty good time in trucking business. And as I've told people in the past, if you don't make money in trucking business right now, you probably ought to find something else to do.
That's about right.
Well, you know, another thing, one thing, Rico and Chuck, I always say, you know, my advice is what I'm going to charge you for it, and I'm not going to charge you for anything.
Well said.
So, Rick.
So, yeah, go ahead, Rico.
Go ahead, Chuck. You got the floor. Go ahead.
No, I'm interested to see what's coming down the pike for our listeners in new regulations for this year that you think is coming down the pike.
Well, we're talking right now about the entry-level driver training regulation that I believe takes effect sometime in the first part of February. I almost said February 7th, but what difference it make? You know, if it becomes effective in February, it's effective. That means that new drivers must complete training programs. They must complete training programs by certified trainers, and they've got to be on the register. I've read a little bit of it. You know, I'm kind of like when I work for the government. Unless a regulation applies today, I don't worry about it. Once it goes into effect, then I'll study up on it, and then I'll help my clients comply with it. But, you know, we got about 50,000. We have a neighborhood of a shortage of 50,000 truck drivers in our country. So now we're talking about doing 18-year-old drivers. Of course, you've already got in effect less than 21 drivers who got military backgrounds, that have some kind of truck driving experience in the military that we can fast track them through their CDL. So we've got, you know, we're hearing now and we're seeing now that we've got to have more truck drivers. But, you know, Rico and Chuck, like you said, if you can't buy a truck, what good's a driver, you know? So that's going to be a problem now for, I perceive it to be not quick, but for some time in 2022, that unless we can get some trucks, some new trucks, and get them out there on the road, then the driver shortage is, will continue to remain. But, you know, I like, you know, Chuck, the last truck driver strike we had was back, I believe, in 1976, if I'm not mistaken. My dad was a part of that. Now, the reason for that strike was fuel prices went from, what, 22, 23, 25, 27 cents a gallon for diesel fuel up to whatever it went to, and truck drivers wasn't making, I mean, truck companies weren't making any money, and the government would not help them because you had those tariffs in place. You had to file tariffs. Tariffs had to be approved. Right. You couldn't charge any more, any less for the freight you hauled than what was in your published tariff. And these guys went out and blocked the road, and the government came up with a fuel surcharge. That is, if you tender a load of freight to a trucker driver, a trucking company, you had to pay them not only the published rate, but a fuel charge, a fuel surcharge on top of that. Now, we see that voluntarily now in our trucking industry. But back in those days, that was a whole other world. So what did the government do? The government immediately corrected it and put in a fuel, the Interstate Commerce Commission. Because I actually, when I was with the IC, I used to go out and do audits on trucking companies to make sure not only they charged the fuel surcharge, but they passed that fuel charge on to owner operators. Now, that's a long time ago. But that's how it worked then. Now we're looking at this. Now we're looking at this COVID thing. We about, like I said, we about back that bobcat as far back in that cave as we can back them. And something's fixing to happen. And people are just getting about all they want of it. Now I got my shots. I got my booster. I was just talking to my neighbor over here a few minutes ago. Well, his son, who's had the shots and had the booster, got it again. So this is not an exact science, you know, and it worries me that these government officials who are in their glory are continuing to put these mandates out there that people have to comply with without any real good, I don't know if it's good science or bad science or junk science, what is it, but you hear too many on the other side, and if the government's not careful, the public will lose confidence in our government. And when you lose confidence in your government, things are not going to go well in our country.
Well, I think that's, you know, it's funny. I was just talking to my wife about this tonight, and I said, you know, this whole thing going on between Russia and Ukraine, Russia is power hungry, and they saw a great opportunity to enforce themselves as the world's policeman now. And they did this because I think the United States, who overall has done a pretty good job in the last century being the world's policeman. There's been some screw-ups, of course, but overall we've had, we did have two world wars, but that had nothing to do with America. You know, you guys didn't have anything to do to start them, but you've done overall, I would give you a high score on what you've done to be the world's policeman. And I'd much rather my neighbors to the south be the world's policeman than anybody else. But I think Russia has seen how divided America is and thought this is a chance to make their move. And I think that's part of it.
That's what these foreign countries do. You know, it ain't like their mindset has changed. It just waits for an opportunity to push a little bit further. They've done that throughout my lifetime, Chuck, and you know, goes back to the Sputnik days. They just wanted to see how far they could push it till we push back, and I'm afraid they're doing it again, you know. But the you know, America's got soft. We've gotten soft. And we just kind of say, well, what if that happens? You know, what's that? How does that affect me? How does that affect my job? How does that affect my income?
Right.
How does that affect my family? This thing is 3,000 miles away from me. Well, it doesn't today, but it might one day. And that's what we got to try to, we got to stop from somewhere, even go back to Vietnam. And I was one that did everything I could do to stay out of Vietnam. I'm not proud of it. It's what we did at the time. I wasn't the only one. At least I didn't move to Canada, you know, like some of the people.
Well,
did.
Lots of them did.
But, yeah. But, you know, at the time, we weren't pleased with that war, but you got to stop communism somewhere. And if communism comes into, what is it, Crimea? If I said that right,
right.
You know,
Germany.
It's
the
just
Kremlin,
one
yeah.
country away from Germany or Europe. I don't,
yeah.
I don't know all this stuff. I just think that somewhere you got to draw a line in the sand. And, you know, right now we don't seem to be willing to draw that line. And it is not just the politicians. I'm not talking about any particular politician. I'm talking about American people.
Yeah. I think everybody's gotten soft, you know, from,
I think I have.
Our parents came from, you know, Rico, that would be your grandparents. They came from a tough generation. They were raised by people who lived through two world wars and the depression. These were tough son of a guns. And I think in a lot of cases, every generation wants to bestow upon their children everything and anything they didn't get.
I think that's definitely the case. I want to try to bring us back around to want to ask Rick, with everything coming down and being the new year, we talked about the 18-year-old. You talked a little bit about them regulating to allow 18-year-olds to drive. Where do we exactly stand on that? I'm not exactly sure. So I know you kind of keep aware on that type of stuff. So is that something gotten the green light? Are we actually in that phase of where that's actually happening, or where do we stand on that? And I got a couple of other follow up questions after that.
Well, you know, I think that Robert Manuel, who was he was a chief, whatever it was, with Obama when he was there. And I don't have his title, but he said one time, never let a good crisis go to waste. Now, what did I say a minute ago? We got 50,000 shortage. We're short truck drivers, 50,000. We're short being able to buy new trucks. I don't know what the numbers are there. So now we've got a crisis. You go down here at Kroger, and you go back there, and there's very little meat in the meat section. There's stuff missing all over the shelves up and down through there. Now we've got a crisis. So what do we do? Now, I'm talking about from an industry standpoint. What do? We run out there and we say, we got to have more drivers. We've got to have more drivers, or we're going to start starving. You know, people are not going to be able to get food. They're not going to be able to get supplies. They're not going to be able to get medicine. What are we going to do? Well, okay, let's let 18-year-old drivers drive. Okay, let's let this bunch of drivers. Let's make it easier to get a CDL. We've got to have more drivers from a government standpoint. The government says, okay, I agree. Let's jump in there and let's make it easier to get into trucking business. And let's make it easier to become a driver in the trucking industry, because we've got this terrible crisis. You know, I always liked this. G. Gordon Liddy, who was in the Nixon administration, and he went to jail because he wouldn't testify against him, you know. But he said something one time I'll never forget about the CIA. He was in the CIA. He said, you know, as long as the people in this country feel safe in their bed and their bellies are full, they're real worried about what we do. But you let them get hungry or scared, and they're not going to care what we do. And I always kind of remembered that. I thought, he's exactly right. He's exactly right. we want to oversee all this stuff. We want to pick it apart. We want to say you should have, would have, could have done this or shouldn't have done this. But you let us get hungry or you let us get scared, and we ain't going to care what the government does to get us food and make us safe in our beds. And I'm afraid that these crises, whether they're real or not, I think these crises are, you're going to see some lessening of the regulations. You're going to see people come into this industry that may or may not come into it. You know, an 18-year-old driver driving 80,000-pound vehicle down the road at 70, 75, 76 mile an hour. I mean, you got to back up and think about this for a minute. But does that solve the crisis of shortage of goods? I don't know. If it does, I'm all for it. But if it increases safety, but at the same time increases the supply of our things we need every day, hey, I may go along with it.
Rick, I think it can be done in a safe environment. I think we've possibly even talked about it on this show. I think that the larger carriers, for the most part, the Schneiders and J.B. Hunts of the world and Werner and all those guys, the mega carriers, I think that they have the resources to be able to take an 18-year-old and train them for 3 years and working training, like have them start in a classroom and then graduate to, driving the trucks into the fuel island or doing whatever, or on a contract with a client at shunting trailers, in one of those yard trucks, yard spotter. And then going out with a city driver, doing local runs and with somebody. And I think over a three-year period, by the time that individual is 21 years old, I think he or she, not all of them are going to do this, but I think that the ones that want to do that and enjoy the work and enjoy the lifestyle, I think they will be the ones filling in the gap. But just, I do agree, taking most 18-year-old kids and throwing them in a truck and saying, here, go from New York to Chicago or New York to California, that's a recipe for disaster. And I don't think most people would do that. Remember that 18-year-olds have been driving trucks since there was trucks. All those farm boys that learned how to drive on the family farm in North Carolina or in Iowa or South Dakota or Tennessee, that's where we got our drivers from as an industry, for the last almost 100 years. That's who the truck drivers were. We've plumb run out of farmers. Now we take some from India, the people from the Punjab region of India, are all farmers. So these men, mostly men, but there are some women, they grew up handling equipment. They were born driving tractors when they were little. They're good with equipment. So, that's our new batch of farmers, but we're even running out of them. We've brought in a whole bunch of people, and now people aren't in such a big hurry to come here the way they were. So we've either got to find another country, or within our own population, we've got to find a new crop of young drivers, and maybe we will not mistreat these people, and maybe they'll want to stay in the industry. Because when you hear some of the antics that shippers and receivers and even at truck stops and some of the things that some trucking companies do to their drivers, you can see why the people that leave the industry are never coming back, because they've got a really foul taste in their mouth. Now, Rick, I got to ask you something that's probably not the most pleasant of subjects, but it's something that we're certainly aware of, especially if you're on social media, especially Instagram. There does seem to be a lot more truck wrecks these days. Can you tell our listeners, if they are involved in a wreck, from your opinion, would you mind sharing what the steps should be for that driver? Because it's something that nobody wants to talk about.
I have these thoughts, but the crashes are not going down, Chuck. the fatal crashes, and that's really the only ones where, well, we measure injuries and we measure property damage, but the crashes are not going down. They haven't been going down now in several years. But on the other hand, you know, I'm kind of like, you know, crashes are up, but mileage is up. The number of trucks on a road. And I used to have to defend this all the time when I was with FMCSA, because they would measure me on how many fatal crashes were occurring in Tennessee. And they'd say, well, Rick, your crashes were up 10% last year. We generally run between 110 and 130. Sometimes we get a little higher fatal crashes, truck crashes in Tennessee. But then I'd have to come back and try to defend myself. I said, you know, if you guys will just simply look, back last year I only had so many trucking companies in my state. I had this number. If you'll look, now I've got 20% more trucking companies that's now based in my state than I did a year ago. The mileage is up. The number of miles we're running with trucks every year continues to go up. And so we finally started measuring truck crashes on per million miles, which I thought was a fair measurement. But now when they'd come after me, you know, I'd say, you know, I did some research, and I found that out of my 120 fatal truck crashes I had that were occurred in Tennessee last year, I've identified which carriers are having crashes. What are you going to do about it? I said, well, out of the ones I've identified, and I'm just using this as an example because I used to aggravate them. I used to cut my head off. I said, well, out of the 120 fatal crashes I had last year, I found that 20% of them were Alabama carriers that were just passing through my state. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to build a gate down there on the Tennessee-Alabama line, and I'm not going to let them Alabama truckers come in my state. Well, you know, they look at me like I was from a foreign planet. But let's go back to the 18-year-old versus 21-year-old. 10% of everybody out there gives us 90% of our problems. We learned that. So if you say, well, that's great. We're going to let Swift, we're going to let Werner, we're going to let all these other big carriers who have these great training programs in place, and they put an 18-year-old in, they're going to ride with them. You got to remember now, 90% of the carriers in this country, the 525,000 carriers that we know exist, have less than 10 trucks. So if you say, okay, we're going to let Swift, Warner, we're going to let you guys use these 18-year-olds, but if we let you use them, we're going to have to let everybody else use them. So now you've got a kid sitting in his room, and he, for $300, files a $300 application for authority, gets his DOT number, and he don't even have a truck. So he goes down there at Ryder Penske somewhere, and he leases a truck. After the initial entry-level training, these are the folks who are going to be out there operating, not the Warners and Swifts and Primes and those carriers who have good programs in place to make sure that they bring these young drivers in and they get these drivers up and trained that they're safe to operate on, you know, in our country. So it's not those folks. It's those other folks that's going to come in. And I don't know nothing about that wreck that happened up there in New Hampshire or somewhere where the driver – allegedly, and I don't know if that's what happened, but he allegedly went across the road and hit all them motorcycles and stuff there. But see, he was operating less than 26,000. He wasn't, I don't think he was 21 years old. I don't know anything about that case other than what I read, so don't, somebody's going to download this and say, this is what you said. But, you know, those are the kind of things that we're going to see. It's not that 90% out there. It's that 10%. That I'm concerned it may cause us problems. I'm not saying we shouldn't do it, because I know when I was 18 years old, I couldn't understand why I couldn't drive a truck. I could go to Vietnam.
I agree.
I could be drafted. Why can't I drive a truck?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you could get drafted, but you couldn't buy a drink because you had to be 21. That same thing.
That's right. Yeah. That's exactly right. So I had to wait 3 years. And the problem with that is once you wait 3 years to be able to drive a truck, you've had to make a living somewhere else, and you're more than likely not ever going to go trucking business after that.
Right, and that's that is the idea behind getting these 18-year-olds involved in the industry, so we don't lose them. If they go to a, if these young people go to a, for post-secondary education, they go to a university, they're going to come out. It depends on what they study, but in some cases they're going to come out with an awful lot of debt. Now. It depends on what they do. If they wanted to be a veterinarian, they would probably have $500,000 worth of debt up in Canada at least. However, if they come out as a veterinarian, the bank will give them 100% financing on setting up a veterinarian clinic. So it's not a bad deal for those ones. But for a student that wants to take up philosophy or political science and rack up student debt, probably not the best use of time or money. And at least with the trucking industry, they would be earning from day one. By the time that person was 21 years old, they would probably, if they played it right with their personal finances, they could probably have enough money for a down payment. And in some regions of the United States, they'd probably buy a house.
I said my dad was an owner-operator at McLean, and Dad made good money. He made, back in the 70s, early 70s and late 60s, Dad made some real good money as an owner-operator at McLean. I mean, Dad was making, because I used to keep his books. What would $50,000 a year be in 1968 today? That's pretty good money.
Oh, my God. That's huge money.
And I was in school, mainly in school, and I'm not proud of this. I was mainly in school to stay out of Vietnam. That was mainly why we stayed.
Right.
Some of us stayed in school, and that's, again, I'm not proud of that now. I look back on that. That wasn't the right thing to do. But then I got into school, college, and then it was a struggle because Dad said, look, if you'll come out of college, I'll buy you a truck. You can lease it to McLean. You can make $50,000 a year. That's hard to turn down. And it was tempting.
It's huge money.
Yeah. And I had a wife, and next thing I knew, I had a little old kid sitting there looking at me for formula, that was hard to do. And my wife, bless her heart, had it not been for her, I think I might have done it. About my junior year, I liked another year, had some college debt. But then I began to realize, of course, I got a little older now. I'm now at 20 years old, and I realized I got 3 years invested in this college. And maybe I was 21 then, because, I got a four-year degree in just 5 short years. I was always kind of proud of that. But I probably had too much fun. But then I started to realize I got all this time and money invested. I always hesitate to say this. Whatever field you start in, you're probably going to stay in for the most part when you first start your career. And I realized if I went in the trucking business, it would be hard for me to go back into something in my education that I did in college. And I just stayed out of it. And I took some jobs that didn't pay nothing like I would have made if I'd bought my truck, trailer. Dad had his own truck and trailer.
Oh, yeah.
And I could have made some good money. And I would have probably done very well. But I hated to waste that education. So that's my thought process, and I'm sure that's the exact same process that we have with people now that are going in college or generating this debt. Now, they can make as much money in trucking. They'll make more money in trucking business than they will make in whatever career they start at. But like I say, once you get in it, it's hard to get out of it.
True. Rick, I've got to tell you, $50,000 in 1968 was, now by And I don't think our standard of living between where you lived and where we lived was that much difference. In 1978 was about five times the average of a working man,
That's right.
Working in a factory or driving a truck. And I had a good friend of mine a little bit later in high school, which would have been a couple of years later, and her dad was the president of a big company. He didn't own it. He was the president. He was a real good marketing genius. And he made $50,000 a year. And we thought this fella could walk on water because he made so much money. And then we hear tonight that your dad was making $50,000 a year at the same time driving a truck, owning his own truck. It just shows you it was a damn good business.
Oh, yeah. Well, you got to remember now, this was 1969, 68, 67.
Yep.
But, you know, they paid, now his were clean, and they were Teamsters, and they operated on tariffs. So they worked on the same tariff that McLean Freight Lines operated on their general commodity divisions. So, I mean, everything was per 100 pound. And I remember Dad would go to, he run out of Memphis for the most part, had a boy down there that was, what do you remember, Chuck, commission agent, Don Powell.
Yep. Sure
and, and Don would get that good freight coming out of Memphis, going up in Shenango Valley up there in Pittsburgh and Cleveland and Youngstown. And they'd run up there, and there were three or four of them there at home. Now, we was in a very rural country, I mean, a very, very rural area of Tennessee. And there was about five of those guys. Dad and five of his friends that had bought trucks and leased them a clean. And they'd go up there, they'd load out on Friday, go up on Sunday night, and they'd get back like Thursday or Friday back in the Memphis or somewhere back in there, and then they'd load back the other way. And it was still on flatbed trailer. This was not dry freight. And you remember those, Chuck, you remember this. You remember, I'm trying to think of that term, exclusive use. And I mean, it paid $3 or $4 a mile, and sometimes they'd have to run all the way to Dallas, and then they'd have to deadhead back to Memphis.
When a shipper marked exclusive use on a bill of lading, you weren't supposed to put anything else on with it.
That's right.
And they paid a hell of a premium. It could be a shoebox, but they
put
exclusive use in.
And you know what they would do?
There's nothing.
Dad and them would set up there in Youngstown or somewhere up in Pittsburgh, somewhere around there, and they'd get an exclusive use. They might load three exclusive uses before they come back west. Oh, and, I mean, that was freight rates, and you could not charge any more or any less than your published freight rate. So if they went to McLean Trucking, they pulled that tariff up and says, so much per 100 pounds exclusive use. Well, they say you got to deliver it like on Friday. Well, they just, I mean, that's up there on Monday, you know. Well, let's just see if I can find another one or two. And you call them brokers now, but back in those days they were agents for McLean.
Right.
And, man, they'd load that trailer up. Here they'd come and, I mean, you know, that. And now, don't misunderstand me. Dad didn't claim $50,000 annual income on that truck. He wrote everything off he could write off, you know. And he wrapped the truck. He'd buy a nice pickup truck. You see, Chuck, you know what I'm talking about. These guys drove brand-new pickup trucks. They lived in nice houses. And they paid taxes on, what, $12,000 a year, you know. but you know, I remember too, because I worked in a grocery store when I was in high school, and those people in that little Genesco, which is a shoe factory there in Tennessee, here in Tennessee, I'm still in Tennessee, don't misunderstand me. Boy, I tell you what, I start talking about this stuff, and I start to feel so old, you know. Those people working in that shoe factory all year, all week long, would bring their checks under that little grocery store I worked in, and it would cash them checks. Them checks would be $55 a week.
That's right. I remember around the same time, my mom ran a flower business, and she would pay her employees $60 or $70 a week. I remember a little bit younger, my dad had a guy working for him with five kids, and he paid him $100 a week, and he couldn't keep him because he was paying him $100 a week, and he wasn't a producer. But, you know, that's things are a lot cheaper, too, though. You could buy a house for, you know, $15,000 or $20,000. And
that's
a good
right.
one at that.
Hey, you know, Chuck, nobody's going to listen to us anymore because we're very old. And you remember when we was kids, when we were kids, we'd hear old people talk about stuff like this. We thought, I don't want to hear that. So I hope anybody listening to us tonight is just kind of indulging us as old folks talking about what used to be the good old days. But I'm going to tell you, the good old days are right now. And I'm a big believer in that, and you better enjoy them because things don't get better as you get older. Hey, Chuck, you know another thing we need to talk about, and I don't know where we are. We got about 10 minutes, looks like. You know, we need to talk about this independent business model. That's going to be a great big deal in the next year or two, and that's for 1099 basically employees. If you're getting 1099, you're being paid by 1099, the government's going to make it much more difficult for people to 1099 you. They're going to make it to where your so-called employer or whoever 1099s you has got to withhold Social Security income tax and provide workman's comp. That's the biggest deal right now that may very well affect our industry in the next few years.
Well, we've got that up, you know, we've got that here in Canada, and we've had it, and we did, Rico and I actually did a 90-minute show on it about 3 weeks ago. The problem being that by law in Canada, federal statute as well as every province, you have to treat your action. I'm not talking about your owner-operators. I'm talking about the people driving your company trucks. You've got to treat them as employees. There's no loophole. You have to take off Canada pension, unemployment insurance, and you have to cover the workman's comp. That is a law. And actually, they can fine the owners of the company if they're not providing proper WSIB, and it goes personal. It actually, the fine will pierce the corporate veil. And I don't want to go into it tonight, but maybe one other night, we will go into it. I got an $800,000 fine once from WSIB, not because my drivers weren't doing everything right. It's because we were giving out work to carriers and not getting their certificates that they had WSIB. They all had it, but we weren't getting the certificates. And
right.
It was a long rigmarole. We finally won, but it cost a lot of anguish and a lot of time and a lot of money. But getting back to the other thing, so in Canada, if you own the truck and lease it on with somebody like Traffix, it's not a problem to pay your corporation. But if you're going to drive a Traffix truck, then you need to be paid on payroll. Now, I think it's a little bit different in the United States, and I think that's what you're talking about, correct? Is paying company drivers as corporations?
Well, see, it started out mainly as a workman's comp deal. And, you know, and it's owner-operators. And, I've seen a lot of carriers, Chuck, that are still 1099 or employees that drive the company trucks. That's not going to fly. Then you got to look at one, workman's comp. Two is the government. Now, these so far, the only ones that does has been the states. Different states. I think California, Connecticut, and I may be wrong, but you know, I'd have to go back. I'd have to estimate those. But yeah, there's several of these states already said you can't even do that on your owner operators unless you show that the owner operator, you know, he does work for people other than you. And
well,
that's
that doesn't work.
Deal.
We all know that.
Yeah. But you know, somebody explained that to me one time. A government employee, of course, you know, they look at things entirely different than me and you do. But they said, look here, all these 1099 employees, we're throwing these 1099s out there at them. And what the government has learned, and, of course, our tax-hungry government, what they've learned is the big part of these 1099 employees are not filing income tax, and they're not paying Social Security, and there's no workman's comp on them.
Right.
Which means...
Exactly.
And here's what it... I'm telling you what they said. I'm not saying what I agree with or disagree with. That if they get hurt, the public's got to take care of them. If they don't pay Social Security, then they get old and start trying to draw Social Security, they won't get enough to live on. And third, the government's not getting income tax. And that's why Biden and them want to hire, 80,000 new IRS agents? And they don't come in and just find you. They come in to a company that's not doing that. And one is not just find you, but two is assess you now. That's different than a fine. Assess you for Social Security withholding and income tax withholding. Income tax, because workman's comp is a state-to-state thing. And I may be totally wrong on that, but that's what this federal employee explained to me.
Yeah, you know, the problem is if you're running a legal business and you're doing things right and you're taking off what we call up here payroll deductions, I don't know what you call it down there, but if you're doing it all legitimately and you're losing the opportunity to hire drivers because the carrier down the road pays everybody on a 1099, makes
That's
it really unfair.
That's exactly right.
You know,
I do work here in Tennessee for a lot of these entertainer coaches, and a lot of them do it. And it's scary to me that one day either the IRS or the state workman's comp folks or somebody walk in there and say, hey, you owe us $20 million. What are you going to do? And, you know, I've got a saying when the government comes after you, that you'll run out of money way before they run out of ink.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're fighting, and also they're fighting you with your money. So you're going to have a hard
time
winning that one.
Yeah, you can't win it. Yeah. You're going to run out of money before they run out of ink. And I talk about ink as letters and assessment. And, you know, you're going to run out of money way before they run out of ink.
You know, sometimes, even when you have done things right, it's sometimes cheaper just to pay the fine than try to fight it.
Well, that's unfortunate. And if you're doing a show with me, I've run into an issue recently with the state of Ohio, and I'd love to discuss that. We're not going to do it tonight, but sometime when you've got time and you feel like indulging me and listen to everything I say, is probably none of it which is right. I'd like to explain what Ohio's doing to our trucking industry.
Well, I'd love to hear it. So we've got to get you back on the show so that you can tell our listeners. You are a wealth of knowledge.
Well,
yeah, I'm looking at the time.
Like
we got about 2
now,
minutes.
Yeah, let me sum it up.
Yeah, we got about two minutes left in
what
the
I
show.
Say on this show is worth, well, I'm going to charge you for it, and I'm not going to charge you a thing. But I enjoy doing it.
Well, Rick, let people know if they can use you, if they need some help.
You know
Rick kind of helps people deal with if you got attitude.
They can find me if they want to find me. They can find me at rickgobble.com or rgobble.com or something. They can find me on the internet. I don't do Facebook and I don't do Twitter. I don't do all that stuff. But you can find me.
All right. Well, Chuck, let people know how they can
Before we, I just want to say to our listeners, if you're having any issues with safety or compliance, don't hesitate to call Rick, G-O-B-B-E-L-L, a little bit different than the turkey, but he does a great job. And for me, I want to thank our listeners. And if they want to get in touch with me, if they're having any issues or they want to get set up with Trafix as a carrier, give me a call. My extension is 203. Phone number is 1-800-388-4352. Again, extension 203. You can also send me an email, chuck@trafix.com. If you're going to send me an email, throw your phone number on there. A lot of times it's easier for me just to call you and see how we can help you. And you can always send me a private message on Instagram at Chuck Snow CEO. With that, Rico, I'm going to let you back in the hole for another week.
All right. Well, thank goodness. I want to thank you guys, the listeners, for taking time out of your schedule to join us this evening. Could have been anywhere else in the world, but you took a little time to hang out with us. And we're always eternally grateful for you doing so. And with that being said, I'm looking forward to getting Rick back on the show. I had a few more questions I wanted to kind of bounce off of him, but as usual, whenever we have him on the show, it just goes way too fast. But ladies and gentlemen, want you guys out there to stay safe, stay healthy, keep it in between the mustard and the mayonnaise, and God willing, we'll talk at the same time, same place next week. God bless you. Good night. For Chuck Snow, Rick Gobble, everybody stay safe out there. God bless you and good night.
God bless you. Catch you on the flip-flop.